This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember, you can subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app. And you can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's paths with an S. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm Jackie P.
I'm John T.
Today we are going to be continuing our series of What's Missing, and today we're going to be talking about healthy shame versus unhealthy shame.
Which, for a lot of you in recovery, you've probably learned something about shame, have been reading about it. Brené Brown's a big name in the shame game right now. Mm-hmm. We're going to depart a little bit from her information, not because we don't find it useful.
Right.
But I think some of the earlier work on shame sheds some new light or some different light on some of the aspects of shame, especially in addiction recovery, that are really important to have a grasp on.
Right. So kind of back in the 70s, 80s, maybe even into the 90s, some of the people who were really looking at, within the addiction field, who were really looking at shame were John Bradshaw and Pia Melody.
Yeah.
And they would talk about healthy shame versus toxic shame, or healthy shame versus unhealthy shame. And I think, you know, I haven't talked about this with Brené Brown, but I think when Brené Brown came along, I'm thinking maybe some of her thinking was, oh, that's a little confusing, healthy shame, unhealthy shame. Let's just separate it out and call it guilt and shame.
I think also your first introduction to shame, trying to differentiate between different kinds of shame, is really confusing, and it's hard. I don't think our body initially registers those very differently.
Yeah.
Kind of takes some processing to get to the bottom.
But some of the things that we knew earlier, you know, and you'll still see this in some of the literature where people talk about that shame is actually an evolved emotion. Like we are wired for it. It's evolved with us over all this time. And so there must be some functional purpose of shame.
I think one of the first light bulb moments I had on that, the functional purpose of shame. Do you remember when we were at the CMAT training, the Money and Work Disorders training? And Bonnie Denduvan was teaching the class, and she was talking about different emotions and how we experience them in the body. And she described what happens physiologically when there's shame.
Right.
And she said when you feel shame, you get a rush of blood from your abdomen up to your head, and the muscles in the back of your neck relax. And so when you have an excess of blood in your head, your train of thought stops. You're not thinking as clearly as you were before. And with the muscles relaxing in the back of the neck, your gaze drops, so you break eye contact with whatever's going on. And she said, how adaptive is that, that when you make a mistake that could hurt somebody else, that your body would say, oh, stop, back up. And she said the experience with shame that we have kind of trained ourselves out of is the rejoin part. Shame is a signal to pause, not a signal to run away and hide and hope you die.
Right.
It's a signal to pause and to think again and to rework your approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes me think of, you know, at my house right now, we're training a puppy.
She's a really cute puppy.
She is a very cute puppy, but she's a puppy. And we have a dog that's like 8 years old, but at the first part of December, daughter number three did a surprise. We have a puppy. And we spent about a month figuring out how we were going to handle this surprise puppy in the family. But anyway, we have a puppy that we're training. And, you know, like, I remember this with our other dog when he was a puppy. Dogs feel shame.
Yeah.
And I want them to feel shame. Because, you know, if I say to her, her name's Zoe, so, you know, if she's going to do something, she's a chewer right now, or, you know, we're still potty training. So she's going to do something, and I say, Zoe, no. You know, she immediately, like, drops her head, her tail goes down, and usually she flips over to her tummy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some shame, where she knows, like, she's starting to cower, like, I'm doing something I'm not supposed to do. But, I mean, 2 minutes later, she's, like, back up and coming at you to get, you know, pets and praise and everything. And so, again, she does re-engage with us very quickly.
Yeah.
But we want her to learn that she can't do that.
Well, and I don't think with that kind of training, you're going to run the risk of that dog not being socialized and being afraid of people.
Right.
I think what is probably going to happen, is that you'll have a dog who understands her place in relation to people, mm-hmm. which I think is really, like, that's how dog social order works. And I think that's how human social right. order works, too.
But if I, you know, were to have a bad day, and I was a rager, and I came home, and I ended up yelling at her and kicking her, she doesn't know what she did because yeah. she didn't really do anything, right? And so now I am acting in a shameless way, and she is going to absorb that shame. And that one she might not come back as quickly from because she didn't do anything that she knows she's not supposed to do. It wasn't her shame mm-hmm. that she's responding to. It's my shame that she's responding to.
And especially if that happens over time, then you have a real shame-based interaction. And that's what mm-hmm. PMLD would distinguish between the healthy shame, which is our own shame,
right?
Which she said doesn't ever hurt us. And it feels like mild to moderate embarrassment.
Right.
Versus the shame that other people put on us. One of the reasons why that hurts and is so toxic is, like you said, we can't trace it back to here's the mistake I made.
Right.
And so here's the correction that I need to do. It's just right. this feeling I am bad.
Right. Because literally, I mean, if I do something bad, right, and this is the why shame has evolved, is it's how it helps us learn to live in community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I should feel ashamed of myself if I violate other people's boundaries, and I should move to correct that or apologize or make amends when I do that. And shame helps me to do that.
And I would say that experience of feeling shame when we violate somebody else's boundaries, that's not necessarily something that needs to be explicitly taught. I think as humans with our mirror neurons and our empathy and all those emotions and the way our brain's wired to help us to connect, I think we feel when people pull back from us.
Mm-hmm.
I think we feel when the room kind of goes silent. And, you know, shame really lets us look inside ourselves and think, what happened?
Mm-hmm. What did I do?
Yeah.
And so our brain usually can say, oh, this is what you did.
And I think in healthy shame, we're able to find an actual cause and see the actual effect and determine what do I want to do about that.
Right.
I think that unhealthy shame is where there's an undue burden from the people around us. Most of that starts with our caretakers, mm-hmm. where there are rules that don't make sense, or mm-hmm. there are behaviors that don't really fit that model of I can feel when I'm out of bounds with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hammer comes down really hard and really fast, and it doesn't make intuitive sense to us.
Right.
So
it's one of those ways, I think, where we now start to carry other people's shame, and our brain is saying, okay, I feel shame. What is this about? And our brain can literally kind of, we rack our brain, so to speak, and we come up with nothing.
Yeah.
Because it's not my shame. I'm carrying, or I have absorbed somebody else's shame who in that way, you know, if somebody else has done something that they should be ashamed of, but they're not, so they are shameless. But that energy is still there, and particularly for kids, I think kids just absorb a lot of energy.
Kids always pick up the energy around
yeah.
them.
And so if the person who did the shameful thing won't absorb it, their children, the other people around them will absorb that shame. Except their brain doesn't know how to process that through. Because now they're feeling shame, but it's not because of something they did. And so I find a lot of times, like if I'm around somebody who is behaving in a shameless way, sometimes I start to get confused. Like that is one of the emotions that I will feel is confusion.
This reminds me, I've only seen this film once and didn't pay close attention. I think more of this is coming up for me because I've been recently rewatching The Office, and Michael Scott refers to this, but reminds me of Devil Wears a Prada.
Oh, the Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I look at that whole organization centered around Meryl Streep's character, uh-huh. and they're all confused. They're all yep. shame-based, and she's the shameless one.
Yes.
I think families can organize that way.
Uh-huh.
You've been doing some business consulting.
Yes.
Companies can organize yep. that way.
Yep.
I think whole societies can organize that way.
Well, and, you know, I've wondered this kind of this question of chicken or the egg, you know, which comes first, because I think most of the time, our initial interaction with a system is our family system.
Yeah.
And so we learn how systems work based on what we learn in our family. And then we begin to interact with all of the systems in our life, whether it's work, whether it's our religious system. We interact with our system in the same dysfunctional way.
Well, and that's what we started describing in episode 5, attachment styles. That's what that is, those basic rules that we kind of hold that template up for every situation we're in, whether that whether that template is appropriate or not.
Right.
It's where the nervous system's set. It's what makes sense to us.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that, you know, it's an either or, like you're either shameless or you're shame filled. I think we bounce back and forth between those two. Uh-huh. Like sometimes, you know, I'm shame filled. And so then I engage in shameless behavior.
I think we can only tolerate that shame filled for so long.
Right.
And that's where I see a really big connection between shame and anger.
Mm-hmm.
I think anger for a lot of folks, or one of the places anger comes from for a lot of folks, is that explosive outgrowth of shame that we've taken on that wasn't ours, or shame mm-hmm. that we took on that was too much, or shame that wasn't useful. Like, we can only carry so much of that before it boils over in us.
Well, and if as young kids we really are absorbing the shame of our parents or the shame of other people, we do become pretty quickly shame-filled. And then it becomes really confusing about our own shame.
Uh-huh.
And so we don't know how to own our own shame because it feels like it's going to kill us, because this other shame does almost kill us, right?
Yeah.
Like, it takes us out of the game, so to speak. And so we get really confused and we just say, shame's just bad.
Yeah. Or I think even in the bigger picture, in addiction, any feeling is bad. Any mm-hmm. real emotion is bad. I think even when it comes to confronting our own shame, there's this level of unpredictability there. Like, how deep does this go?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a few clients that I'm working with right now that we're working on their ability to feel and respond to healthy shame.
Mm.
And it's like, I don't know, it's like I'm asking them to jump into a volcano sometimes.
Mm.
Like, what's going to happen if I put my toe in this? Is this going to burn me? Is this going to go deep? Like, are we going to find out that I'm the root of every problem in my life?
That I'm just a horrible human being.
Yeah. And that's even just when we're starting with, no, you agreed that flipping that person off on the way to your appointment wasn't good.
Right.
We started with something that you said, I'm not proud of this. And then trying to go deeper into that, or trying to even talk about that, you get this big pushback.
Well, and Carl Jung kind of talked about this where, you know, we all kind of have a shadow side to us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the shameful things that we do may reside sometimes in the shadow. I don't think all of the shadow behavior are necessarily unhealthy or shameful.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times we're very uncomfortable with anybody seeing our shadow side, mm-hmm. and we think that we need to extinguish the shadow. And so what happens is the more we repress that part of ourselves, the more we're uncomfortable with people seeing that, the more extreme it becomes.
It's been really interesting as we have done couples work together with, mm-hmm. with our clients. It's been interesting to see, with very few exceptions, when you get two people in a room together who have some kind of commitment to each other and they start owning what they feel shame about,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting how the exact opposite of what they fear starts to happen in most cases.
Yeah.
I've seen that be a really calming effect on a really escalated couple, when somebody can start to say, I don't feel good about how I've been treating you.
Yeah.
Or I don't know what to do with this. I'm really overwhelmed and I'm just sad that I've taken us to this mm-hmm. place. And usually when we'll stop and check in with these people, and we'll say, I want you to feel the response that your spouse is having to you
mm-hmm.
right now. A lot of the times they just glossed over that. Like, we had a session this week where after one partner had revealed something that was shameful and was working on owning the shame, the other partner had opened the door like, hey, I want you to find out more about me. Like, why don't you ask mm-hmm. me more about this? And they glossed right over it.
Yeah, huge invitation.
Yeah.
And they missed it.
Didn't even see it. And we paused and we talked about where that person was in the shame.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think when you are in that shame, especially the toxic shame or your own shame, but it's mixed with all the other carried shame that you have, we don't really believe that we are acceptable. So when somebody offers us that invitation to be our messy self and that they will not abandon us if we are messy, we can't see that. It doesn't show up on our radar because that's not what we believe in that place.
And I think the core beliefs underneath toxic shame versus healthy shame make a big difference in how we start responding to it. If we believe I am horrible,
right,
or I am bad instead of I did something bad, it's really... It's interesting as we work with clients on that and we start to get focused on behavior, how quickly they can transition out of the deep shame and start to look at, oh, you're right, like I would want to do something about that.
Yeah.
I would want to correct that.
I had a session a couple weeks ago and one of my clients, a male addict, was talking to me about, you know, some of his past behavior. And he said, like, I can really be an asshole sometimes. And I was like, yeah, you know, you're right.
Correct.
And then he asked me, he said, you probably work with a lot of assholes, right? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, does that just drive you crazy? And I said, actually, no, what drives me crazy is when I come across an asshole in my regular life, but we can't talk about it.
So true.
I said, I mean, I can be an asshole too sometimes, right? So, but at least I know I can. And I'm fine if you act like an ass, as long as we can talk about it and you can acknowledge, like, what was I thinking? What was I doing? I don't have no problem with that. It's the people who I have to pretend I didn't see what I just saw and I can't talk about what that was. And they have to still believe that that wasn't anything to do with their shadow.
Yeah.
That's the ones I have an issue with.
Well, and that, like, I think that illustrates really well what a relationship that does healthy shame can do, is we can admit mistakes or we can say, like, oh yeah, that's that asshole part of me.
Yeah.
And we can own it. And it's not like, it's not a deal breaker for either person.
Right.
It's not the worst thing in the world that's ever happened. It's just, yep, that's that side of me. And I'm still working on that.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, I'll use the example sometimes with people, you know, especially addicts, if they're coming in and saying, well, that was my addict that did that, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, let's go back and let's say that, like, if I have a dog, which I do now, a puppy too, but let's say that I have a dog and on garbage day, my dog gets out and goes up and down the street taking out everyone's garbage and makes a mess of the neighborhood street. I can't be like, well, it wasn't me. That was my dog, right? Like, I am responsible. Because my dog is dependent upon me, I am responsible for what my dog does. So I'm going to have to, you know, hopefully recruit my kids, and me and my kids are going to be walking up and down the street picking up all the garbage that our dog strewn up and down the street because I'm responsible for that. And, you know, I'm it may be mildly to moderately embarrassing that my dog did that, right? But that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean I'm an irresponsible dog owner. Dogs get out, and if it's garbage day, you better watch out. But I still have to be responsible to clean up the mess.
Well, and I think there's some relief in the shame. Like, it can start as something that feels, I think, more than mildly to moderately embarrassing. But I think there's something about stepping into that arena and taking responsibility for our actions that actually brings some resiliency. And we can say, yeah, my dog got in your garbage. I am so sorry.
Yep.
As we're in the act of cleaning it up. And I think the shame, like it's designed to do, I believe, becomes a non-issue because we've re-engaged in a way that is more relationship positive or is more in line with our integrity or our values.
And that's something I think that functional mature adults are capable of doing and need to do. Like, that would be a trait of a functional mature adult. It's one of the things we're teaching children to do. But by the time we hit, you know, some adulthood, and not necessarily 18 or 21, but by the time we hit adulthood, we should be able to have those skills.
Well, and you, I think you mentioned something key there, that that's something that parents teach children.
Right.
That's how we've form into functional adults, is we have parents who model it for us. We have parents who talk with us. We have parents who help us to reflect on our own behavior. When we don't have that, we are kind of left to our own devices, and kids hide really well. Kids lie really well.
Right.
Kids don't tolerate emotion very well.
Well, and if our parents are still hiding from their own shame or not knowing how to navigate their own shame, then that is what they teach us.
Yeah.
They teach us to blame. they teach us, you know, to point the finger. Like, somebody's at fault. It's not me, but I'll find out who it is.
Yeah. And I think when that comes to dealing with shame, that whole finger-pointing thing, one of the first levels that I see people who are really good blamers go to when they're trying to take responsibility is now they're to blame for everything, mm-hmm. and they have to make up for it.
Yeah.
I was talking with a client this morning about that, and he has this running list of what I'm supposed to do before I'm acceptable going in his head. And it's been in his head his whole life.
Mm.
And so we were talking this morning. He's really been working on some empathy and I think doing some good work with that. And he was saying, I'm recognizing mistakes I make. Now, how do I make it right? And he said, because as soon as I start thinking about what I need to do for my spouse or what I need to do for other people, I'm back into that damn list that mm-hmm. has haunted me the whole mm-hmm. time. And so we started to talk about what his values are and how when he does something that hurts another person, which values does that violate? And I think the act of making amends or the act of acting responsibly is not just about setting it right out here.
Right.
I think we need to go as far as we can to do that. Like the example of the dog and the garbage, we need to go as far as we can to clean up that mess there. I think part of the amends is looking at the value that made us clean up the garbage in the first place.
Uh-huh.
I value other people's space. I value courtesy. I value consideration.
Yeah.
So maybe part of that amends to get us in line with that is we make sure the dog doesn't get out again.
Right.
And we're not doing that so that we can hold up the scorecard to the neighbor and see, look how good I'm doing with this.
Right.
We're doing that so that we can say, I'm now living within my values again, and that feels safer for me.
Right.
That feels good for me. I use the example with him because this happens too often at my house. My boys really like to wrestle, and I feel like my job when we're wrestling is they get to be as wild and crazy as they want, and my job is to make sure that they don't crash.
Mm.
And if I get too far into it or too careless, inevitably somebody hits their head hard.
Mm.
And I always feel bad. I always get that feeling like 2 minutes before it happens, like this is probably a good place to stop. But then I keep going. And I've noticed that after that, I get very soft with them.
Mm.
I can't make the headache go away. Usually our wrestling matches end in us like snuggling in this big pile, reading a book or mm-hmm. just talking or something like that because they've hit their head and now it's time to be soft. But I've realized for me that getting soft is not to make the pain in their head go away. I know I can't do that, but that's to get me back in alignment with my value of protecting them mm-hmm. and keeping them safe
mm-hmm.
And helping them hopefully being a person that they can feel safe with.
Right.
And so that's what that action is not erasing the memory of the pain from them, but me getting back in line with my value. So I think when we're dealing with healthy shame that impels us to action, here's the mistake I made. It really becomes about us looking inward, seeing where we're out of alignment with our values and correcting.
Right. Well, us. And that makes me think, you know, sometimes I'll have clients who will say things like, you know, I'm just not a very trusting person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk to them and say, okay, the goal, like we paint trust with such a broad stroke, like
yeah.
that being trusting is good and being non-trusting is bad, as if it works that way. Right. And I will tell them, like, the reality is, with trust, I need to be able to trust the right people
mm-hmm.
and not trust the right people, right? So I actually need to be non-trusting at times.
Yeah.
But if I think of this in all or nothing, I either need to be trusting or I am non-trusting, which is bad, then I've kind of missed the point. And kind of what you were talking about, I think as we work with a lot of couples, you know, and there's been damage and there needs to be repair and amends and rebuilding, you know, sometimes we'll get the question, like, how do I get my spouse to trust me again? And usually all I will say, you know, to the addict, well, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't make her or him trust you again. What you can focus on is being trustworthy and acting within your values and principles. But again, we're not going to do that perfectly.
Yeah.
And recovery doesn't make us do that perfectly either. And that's okay. Because if I know that I stepped too far, or I know that I said something and then later I'm like, oh, that was kind of insensitive of me. And I can go back and say, hey, when I said this, like, I don't think I was really being sensitive. I had a client just this week, and, you know, she was kind of in a really depressive funk. And her husband was, you know, saying, "Are you okay?" And he was like, "Let's go to yoga together." And she was like, "I just can't get out of bed today." And he was like, "Okay, well, I'm going to yoga." And she said he left, he went out to the garage, he was getting in the car, and she's like, and then he came back in and he was like, "That was very insensitive of me." Hmm. Like, I'm just like, "Have fun with your depression. I'm going to yoga."
Sucks,
you know?
To be you.
And he was like, "Tell me what's going on." And she was like, in that moment, like, yeah, he had kind of been a jerk, but I trusted him so much more and I really valued him so much more when he came back and said, "I just made a mistake." I mean, that wasn't his words, right? But he kind of was like, "That was insensitive of me." And she was like, "It didn't matter that he was insensitive. What mattered is that he could come talk to me about it and say, can I have a redo? Or, you know, let me come back and do this again. Like, I wasn't even thinking about that. I certainly didn't mean to send that message. But on second thought, I can see how it did send that message." And so I think, you know, with trust, it's so much more about, you know, and even trusting ourselves. Like, I don't trust myself to never make mistakes.
Nor should you.
Exactly. Because I'm not that.
Yeah.
But I trust myself to sense when I do and to know what to do about that.
Yeah. And, you know, I always learn a lot when we record these conversations. And for me, the big theme that's emerging today is it's okay to be a jerk as long as you can talk about it.
Exactly.
And so that's the take-home message for John is that's what healthy shame is. It's okay to have flaws as long as you can talk about it.
Right.
And as long as they're really your
own
flaws.
Or other people can talk about it too, right?
Yeah.
It's not just like, because sometimes I may be doing something and I don't realize that that came across insensitively. But if I have a friend or my spouse or my kids can say like, "Mom, that was a little bit insensitive," I can be like, "Oh, was it?" I had this experience just a couple weeks ago. We had some friends over to the house and we were talking and I was just kind of saying something that I said and the husband just started laughing and I was like, "What?" And he was like, "I can't believe you said that." And he was like, "That just sounds so," I don't remember the word. And I was like, "Oh, I didn't even think that it could sound that way because it wasn't what I meant."
Yeah.
But I was like, "You're totally right. It could have come across that way. I don't know if it did. I better check that out."
Yeah. I think this is probably a good place to pause on healthy shame. We're glad that you listen, and we want to remind you that your story matters. Remember, there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story until it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
And our new website is up, so you can comment on episodes now. We would love to hear what you thought about this, so leave us a comment.
Thanks. This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
And remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.